Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Wer die Finanzen eines Unternehmens managt, ist oft beschäftigt. Sehr beschäftigt. Sehr, sehr, sehr beschäftigt. Konto ist das All-in-One-Geschäftskonto, um Ihr Unternehmen zu managen. Egal, ob Sie selbstständig sind oder die Finanzabteilung eines mittleren Unternehmens leiten. Mit Konto erledigen Sie alles in einer App. Geschäftskonto schnell eröffnet? Erledigt. Ausgabenmanagement? Erledigt. Buchhaltung und Reporting? Erledigt. Konto. Das Geschäftskonto, das zu Ihnen passt.
Hello and welcome to News Hour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London with me, Paul Henley. In Iran, the only reformist candidate in presidential elections will face a runoff at the end of next week with an ultra-conservative rival. The reformist Masoud Pezeshkian is still ahead of the conservative Saeed Jalili by a significant margin, but the first round of voting was inconclusive and marked by historically low turnout and more than a million spoilt ballots. The election follows the death of the ultra-conservative president Ibrahim Raisi, who was killed in a helicopter crash last month. These residents of the capital, Tehran, said what they wanted to see from an incoming president.
Definitely, in any point that the relationship of Iran with another country needs improvement, surely the coming president is supposed to work on it.
My expectation is that the incoming president should take positive steps for the country, meaning he should be a people person and be practical, not just words-based, but he should act on what he says.
Let's get a bit more understanding of this election and how it's going from Siavash Ardalan from BBC Persian. He joins me live. The two candidates remaining, Siavash first, make the distinction between them. Tell us a bit more.
Masoud Pezeshkian, the leading contender, is a pro-reform politician. He used to be a heart surgeon before, used to be the deputy secretary of parliament, and he has managed to, despite not having a lot of charisma, inject some excitement into his supporters' base, the reformist camp, who have been pretty much alienated and marginalized throughout the years by the hardliners who are currently running the country. On the other hand, you have Saeed Jalili, who is as far right a politician as he can get on the Iranian political spectrum. He has had different posts in the country. He used to be a nuclear negotiator, and many people thought he actually wanted to sabotage the nuclear deal because he is pretty much against it. And unlike Masoud Pezeshkian, he believes that the sanctions are not an issue. The problem with Iran is that it's not aligned enough with China, with Russia, and it's not exploiting its domestic potential enough. And once it does that, it can become a player on its own terms without needing any kind of Western help or Western investment.
Is a vote for the reformist candidate as close as you can get to a protest vote in Iran? Perhaps not, judging by the number of people who spoilt their ballot papers.
No, you could really say the protest votes are the people who did not vote, who preferred to stay away from the polling booths. And that's a significant majority. 60% did not choose to vote. And those really acted in engaged in an act of civil disobedience, just delivering a message of defiance to the clerical establishment. Those people who do have some hope that the system can be reformed from within are the people who voted for Masoud Pezeshkian, or people who simply voted for him in order from things not going from bad to worse.
And the third placed candidate might be important now. Can you explain?
The third place candidate was the center-right candidate, Mohammad Baqir Ghalibaf. He managed to secure 13% of the votes. And because of that, he can be considered the kingmaker because he has now endorsed the far-right politician Saeed Jalili. And if all his supporters follow his lead and decide to vote for Saeed Jalili, then in the second round of election, he may very well become the president. So that goes a lot. It depends a lot on the inner dynamics between the conservative camp, which have had, you know, very bitter rivalries among themselves. But the real kingmakers, of course, are those 60% who didn't vote, who are now faced with this question. Do we still continue to deliver our message of defiance against the entire Iranian clerical theocracy? Or do we go and vote in the hope that at least there won't be a hardline president in charge of the country?
And the final runoff is upcoming. Is a low turnout expected again?
Well, it all really depends how they answer the latter question, whether those Iranians who have chosen to stay away from the polling booths see any difference between the two politicians that have emerged from this regime. Some people think there is no difference, that it's just a waste of time to really pin any hope on any politician for any kinds of reform, while others think actually it's a good thing for a hardliner to become president because then he might take the country down a very confrontational path with the West, provoking the West maybe to take a more hardline stance against Iran, maybe direct military involvement in the hope that the regime could be overthrown. So
interesting.
Everyone has their own call. It's really become a personal choice, now a subject of discussions and many a conversations between Iranian families and friends.
Thank you, Siavash Ardalan from BBC Persian. Professor Syed Mohammad Marandi is a political analyst based at the University of Tehran and a government loyalist. I put it to him that a particularly low turnout in that first round would be seen as a lack of faith in the system.
No, because if we look back to the funerals of President Raisi 40 days ago that took place in multiple cities, we saw that millions of people came to the streets. In the city of Tabriz, for example, where the turnout was for the election was low, the numbers that came to the funeral were much higher. So I don't think it's reflective of any lack of support for the Islamic Republic of Iran. But I think it does show that none of the candidates were exceptionally attractive.
So the election does seem to have quite a clear result, at least in the first round. And the leader is a so-called reformist. How might things change in Iran were he to take power?
He is clearly from the reformist camp. He's a moderate reformist. He was one of the three people who the reformist camp put forward as their candidate from the very start. He has a strong chance of being elected. I think it will depend on his performance in the upcoming debate. So far, from what we've seen in the previous debates, we had 20 hours of debates between the different candidates and hundreds of hours of each of the candidates being on public television. So far, no one stood out and no one was particularly charismatic. And that's why the vote was divided. And that's also why the turnout wasn't high. It was pretty low. But since there will only be two candidates now, I think that there will be a greater chance for them to express their views and for people to make a decision.
I suppose I called Masoud Pezeshkian a so-called reformist because, of course, he is part of the establishment, even though he's proposing some changes. There are sociologists in Iran who say that no leader from the current system will be able to show the transformation of society in Iran in recent times. Clearly, that's something you disagree with.
Well, I think you would find sociologists in the UK who would be saying the same thing about the United Kingdom. But the fact is that the United Kingdom has elections and people will be elected from Labour or Conservative or now new forces that are at play. And your government will continue to function. And I doubt that the BBC will call it illegitimate. So I think that it's quite clear that you have very differing political views in the political establishment in Iran. And they make their case on television and different people are elected and the state will continue to function. And as I said before, the notion that the Islamic Republic of Iran does not have popular legitimacy is not very sensible.
Professor Mohammad Mirandi from the University of Tehran there. Ali Vaez is the Iran Project Director at the International Crisis Group and joins me now live. What do you make first, Ali, of Dr. Mirandi's argument, that the low turnout does in no way signify a lack of faith in the system?
I think he's closing his eyes on what's really happening in Iran. It's completely, I think, misguided to judge the regime support by funerals of officials. Often these funerals are state organized. Plus, you don't have exact numbers, whereas in the elections, you have exact numbers. And we know that despite encouragement by the senior leadership, in this election, 8% less than the electorate who went to the polls in 2021 showed up. And that is, in fact, the fourth time in a row that we have hit record lows in participation rate. But do you think that already sends a message to the regime.
Do you think, though, that voters could be energized in the second round if they see a chance to get a reformer in power?
I think the biggest mobilization factor, honestly, in the second round would be a fear factor, because Mr. Jalili is a far-right candidate who is very well known to the public. It was under his leadership when he was National Security Advisor that Iran was put under UN sanctions and was considered as a threat to international peace and security under UN Charter's Chapter 7. He isolated Iran. He brought tremendous amount of pressure, economic pressure through sanctions. And people are afraid that now, as president, he would even do worse. And so the reason I think we might see some degree of higher mobilization is not for the hope of the better, but is because of the fear of the worse.
Isn't it the case that at the moment the president has fairly limited power?
He has, but he's also not insignificant. If you get 180-degree difference between President Trump and President Biden, in Iran you get 45-degree difference. But that 45-degree difference will change the destination for the country, and therefore it's not insignificant.
And the battle for supreme leader succession, is that at play here? Because the supreme leader of Iran is not in good health, is he?
Well, he's 85. He seems relatively healthy for his age. His father lived to be 105, so he has good genes. But the reality is that the succession is looming large. And now it's going to be a process that will be completely separate from the presidency, because whoever wins in the second round is not going to be a cleric. And by Iranian constitution, you need to be an ayatollah in order to become the supreme leader. So I think that process is now going to be cooked up in a parallel process that it has nothing to do with who the next US, Iranian president will be.
And just clarify, the final vote is when, and when is the result?
The final vote is next Friday, July 5th, and the result should be known by July 6th.
Many thanks for explaining about the upcoming final round of the Iranian presidential elections. That's Ali Vaez, who's Iran Project Director at the International Crisis Group. You're listening to NewsHour, live from the BBC World Service. We have much more to come. Coming up, President Biden is back on the campaign trail in New York a day after the city's most influential newspaper urged him to drop out of the race for the White House. We'll be hearing from senior Democrat Sidney Blumenthal about the aftermath of President Biden's bad performance in last week's television debate.
He was more than shaky. He lost the plot. He looked terrible. The optics were beyond terrible. And then we'll see what happens and whether or not the public, as opposed to the elite media, makes a decision here.
One other headline for now at this hour. Officials in Ukraine say Russian attacks on towns and villages in the south and east of the country have killed at least 11 people over the course of Saturday. I'm Paul Henley with NewsHour, live from the BBC. Human rights groups in Kenya are warning against the continued use of soldiers on the streets of major cities. At least 30 people have been killed in demonstrations that began as a protest against steep tax increases proposed by the government. The government since changed its mind on those, but the draconian measures it's taken to crack down on dissent have sparked outrage, and more protests are planned this coming week. Irungu Houghton is head of Amnesty International in Kenya, which sent observers to assess the military and police responses.
It's been an extraordinarily intense week in many ways, Paul. The observers picked up on a number of areas of police misconduct. There was, in some cases, excessive use of tear gas and the shooting of tear gas canisters at quite short range. We had a number of injuries as people were hit by the tear gas canisters. There was also a number of abductions that took place, a number of people who were pulled into vehicles or taken from their homes in the middle of the night and essentially held incommunicado for 6 to 12 hours, and in some cases, even 2 days. Much of this built up into a crescendo on Thursday, which was the day that the parliament was stormed, where we saw a number of youth shot in the capital city, but also in several other counties across the country.
And why are you warning that continuing to deploy the military to try to restore order could worsen the situation?
It's unprecedented that the military should be brought in to manage the right to assembly. And this is a constitutional freedom that, you know, in our laws. I think the last time this happened, there was a coup d'etat. It was in 1982. So it's over 40 years ago that we had this scenario of military tanks and military officers guarding vital installations, and that's the parliament, state house, and various other government buildings. So it is a very strange situation. Now, as Amnesty International, we have recognized that the president did not call for a state of emergency, and therefore the constitution still remains the legal framework within the military deployment as well as the police. If the military are going to be deployed to police civilians, then they have to work within the policing guidelines that ensure that the right to life is respected, that there is only proportional use of force, and that there's not excessive use of force, and not the kind of infractions that we've seen earlier this week.
Sure. At the same time, peaceful protest is perfectly legal and constitutional in Kenya. Violent protest is not. And there has been a lot of violent protest.
Yeah, the violence really picked up on Thursday. And I think what, in our analysis happened was that the initial approach of the protesters, which was essentially, remarkably peaceful. I mean, you had thousands of people across different, the capital city and different towns across Kenya, and many of them were carrying nothing more threatening than the constitution or roses or flags. And I think the pressure that they received, the violence that they received from the police, built up the kind of anger that we saw exploding on Thursday. I think there are two other dynamics that we as Amnesty are very concerned about. The first is the use of camouflaged, non-uniformed or plainclothed police officers who were arresting and essentially dragging people into unmarked vehicles throughout the course of Thursday. And then the second one was, quite clearly, they had been mobs of armed hoodlums or criminals that had been introduced into the protests. And it's not clear at this stage whether these were simply opportunistic, efforts to try and take advantage of the situation, or that they were actually paid to come and do this and therefore invoke the kind of police backlash that we saw towards the end of the day.
That's a big accusation to make without evidence.
Really, at this moment, it's really speculative.
To say but that the most violent elements of the crowd were plants put there to inflame the situation, that is an extremely contentious argument to make.
It is, and I do take the sense that, I think when we complete the investigations, we'll be able to get a sense of how much of this was at play. But we do have testimony from protesters that say that many of the people that they saw surging forward were not people that were known to the protesters. Now, of course, in a situation where you have thousands of people, it is not possible that everyone would know each other. So we have to take this with a grain of salt. But there is enough testimonies we're getting from protesters saying that the people that were beginning to uproot branches or beginning to pick up pavement slabs were people that they didn't recognize. Now, I think we need to do further investigation so that we can concretely, either rest this allegation or essentially prove it. So I would say this is a line of investigation that we're following rather than a conclusive statement.
Irungu Houghton there, head of Amnesty International in Kenya. We're trying to get a response for those allegations from the Kenyan government. We'll bring that as soon as we get it. The BBC World Service did speak to an official from the governing party this morning before that interview with Amnesty, who alleged that there were foreign infiltrators among the protest crowds. Now, a new session of Parliament began at the start of this week in India. Earlier this month, Narendra Modi was re-elected Prime Minister, but with a smaller mandate after his ruling party, the BJP, failed to win enough seats for an outright majority. This is uncharted territory for Mr. Modi, who for the first time in his political history is running a coalition government. What does what's been called Modi 3.0 mean for India? The BBC's South Asia correspondent Samira Hussain reports from Delhi.
A raucous beginning to a new session of Parliament as Prime Minister Narendra Modi walks towards the podium to take his oath.
I, Narendra Damodar Das Modi, jo Lok Sabha ka.
Members of the opposition, well, they're holding up copies of India's constitution. It's a jibe at the Prime Minister by the opposition, led by Rahul Gandhi. He's the leader of the Indian National Congress.
The attack that the Prime Minister is launching on the constitution is not acceptable to us. We will not let this happen.
Now, if day one is anything to go by, this new session of Parliament will likely be a combative one. I've come to the Centre for Developing Societies to speak with Sanjay Kumar, and he is a political analyst.
Hi.
What are some of the issues that are really going to test Prime Minister Modi and this coalition government?
The UCC, Uniform Civil Code, that's on the agenda of the BJP. It was on the agenda of the BJP. It is not going to be easy for the government now to take such bold decision, take it forward.
The UCC is a set of laws that would replace the option for Indians of specific religious groups to follow rules based on that faith group. Muslims see it as the government trying to put limitations on their religious freedoms. And it's part of the reason why Apurvanand Jha, a professor of Hindi literature at Delhi University, believes Mr. Modi will continue with the politics of divide. What do you expect from this government?
He will remain an authoritarian person, and he has now exposed himself fully in the last 3 months that his anti-Muslim politics is what gives him life. So I think those policies will continue. The policies which marginalize, isolate, corner Muslims, take away their rights by enacting laws, by executive orders, by political decisions, and by unleashing violence by organized groups. So that is going to continue.
And the residents there outraged.
11 gharon par chal gaya bulldozer.
We're looking at residents in that complex, very upset with the fact that that Muslim woman was awarded that apartment.
Homes of Muslim families bulldozed, mobs attacking Muslims believed to be slaughtering cows. Examples, Apurvanand says, proves his point. Mr. Modi and the BJP have repeatedly rejected claims that they are anti-Muslim. Speaking to reporters outside Parliament, the Prime Minister said he will serve his country and fulfill the hopes and aspirations of everyone in India, all 1.4 billion people.
The BBC's Samira Hussain reporting from Delhi, BBC World Service and NewsHour.
Wer die Finanzen eines Unternehmens managt, ist oft beschäftigt. Sehr, sehr, sehr beschäftigt. Konto ist das All-in-One-Geschäftskonto, um Ihr Unternehmen zu managen. Egal, ob Sie selbstständig sind oder die Finanzabteilung eines mittleren Unternehmens leiten. Mit Konto erledigen Sie alles in einer App. Geschäftskonto schnell eröffnen? Erledigt. Ausgabenmanagement? Erledigt. Buchhaltung und Reporting? Erledigt. Konto. Das Geschäftskonto, das zu Ihnen passt.
Welcome back to NewsHour. Pressure is building on Joe Biden to step aside as US presidential candidate in November following what almost all observers concluded was a bad performance in Thursday's TV debate with Donald Trump. Previously sympathetic newspapers and broadcasters have been crying out for him to stand down. Sidney Blumenthal is a former senior advisor to both Bill and Hillary Clinton. He's described Mr. Biden's debate performance as agonizing. I asked him if that meant he had to go.
I'm not calling on President Biden to step aside. I think the situation, however, is perilous. He had a terrible debate. It was more than simply a bad debate. As President Obama said, he has had bad debates, but it was worse than that. And it revealed Biden at his worst and showed all of his limitations. He was more than shaky. He lost the plot. He looked terrible. The optics were beyond terrible. And then we'll see what happens and whether or not the public, as opposed to the elite media, makes a decision here. And the party leadership is really waiting on public opinion much more than the editorial board of the New York Times.
Right, but you say this was a terrible performance. You also say he cannot hope for a recovery through a future performance, and yet you're not calling for him to stand aside.
Well, it's not up to me. And he's a very stubborn individual, and his own self-image is of somebody who has been persistently underestimated and has risen over all of the obstacles. And he sees this, I'm sure, as another incident in that pattern.
Well, you're not selling him as a wise man and a possible winner.
Well, oddly enough, the first poll after the debate shows him gaining 1 point. And it's confounding to people and completely against the grain of all of the editorials and pundits calling for him to step down. Everything is at stake, as I wrote in The Guardian. I said that, you know, I saw Western civilization passing before my eyes as Joe Biden drowned. If he loses this election and Donald Trump is elected, no one can tell how bad it'll be. Certainly the Western alliance will be broken. Certainly Vladimir Putin will be popping the champagne with Trump as his sidekick. And democracy in the United States will be under assault. So those are the stakes. And Biden did not make the case. He has begun now to step forward from his disastrous performance. But the party itself is watching. And we're going to have to see whether or not a week or two from now, he is tanking the party candidates down ticket for the House and the Senate.
You haven't got long to watch. I mean, this contest is coming up quite soon, and the window of opportunity for changing the candidate is especially small.
That's absolutely correct. And people are in a state of barely restrained panic. And now, a few days later, they're a little more constrained, and they're watching and waiting to see what the polls are and whether or not the party is hurt down the line.
Former senior Democrat advisor Sidney Blumenthal. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Paul Henley. It's 10 years since Islamic State militants tried to wipe out the Yazidi people in the Sinjar region of Iraq. They massacred thousands of men and raped and enslaved girls and women. Now survivors face a new fear as the Iraqi government tries to move them out of the camp they're in. The move's been criticised by the UN Refugee Agency. Caroline Hawley spoke to several of the women who live in the camps. They are members of a Yazidi choir, which has been performing in the UK to highlight the plight of their community. You might like to know in advance, the report contains graphic descriptions of violence.
They sing together to showcase their culture. And they know too that music can heal. Their people have suffered an unimaginable collective ordeal, and the pain is still raw.
My name is Amira. I am from Iraq. I was in Sinjar. I live in Khanki.
Amira managed to escape IS fighters by fleeing up the mountainside. But tears roll silently down her cheeks as she tells me what happened to her two older sisters, who were both taken as slaves. Because they were mothers, they weren't raped, but there were beatings and gruesome threats.
My sister gave birth 15 days before she was captured, and IS said to her, "We will kill your baby and force you to eat his flesh."
This was Vian Dakhil, Iraq's only Yazidi politician, making a desperate appeal in the country's parliament back in August 2014, saying her people were being slaughtered. She begged for help to save them, drawing global attention.
And can I ask why, looking back at that, brings tears to your eyes now?
Because with the catastrophe, it is not finished. Still my people in the camps. Still we have 1,000 girls kidnapped by ISIS.
She says many young women are still unaccounted for and the Yazidis feel abandoned. The Iraqi government wants to close the camps where they live. Life in tents is tough, but many Yazidis are scared to go back to Sinjar. Their homes are gone, and they say there's not much but rubble to return to.
The situation is very dangerous in Sinjar because there are many armed groups in Sinjar, like PKK. The Iraqi army, it is very weak. There are no anything, no building, no houses, no schools, no hospitals.
My name is Zahra. I'm from Shengal. I'm 28. I'm the office manager of Amar Foundation in The Hague.
The Amar Foundation is a charity which supports Yazidi women with music lessons and healthcare clinics. It brought the choir to perform in the UK to raise awareness of the Yazidis' plight.
There are still too many Yazidi girls who are still in captivity and no one is asking for them. The Iraqi government doesn't care about them. There are too many ISIS fighters who have been released from the prisons.
This is Hadia singing about the persecution of her people. In her mind is her cousin Ghazal, captured by IS when she was just 8 years old. By the time Kurdish forces rescued her, she'd been married off and had 2 children, who she had to leave behind as she was freed. It's hard to imagine the trauma this community has endured. But the women are determined to raise their voices. They want to celebrate their identity, and as they deal with their collective pain, they ask the world not to forget.
Caroline Hawley with that report. So, the caliphate was declared at the start of Ramadan in 2014. It stretched from Aleppo in Syria to Diyala in Iraq. This video claims to show Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi's rare appearance in Mosul in July that year, giving a sermon at a mosque days after ISIS declared the caliphate. Baghdadi was killed during a US special operation in Idlib in Syria in October 2019. Here's the then US President Donald Trump celebrating his death at a White House press conference.
The United States has been searching for Baghdadi for many years. Capturing or killing Baghdadi has been the top national security priority of my administration. U.S. Special Operations Forces executed a dangerous and daring nighttime raid in northwestern Syria and accomplished their mission in grand style.
Caliphate no longer exists, of course, but IS is far from a spent force. I've been speaking to 2 people who followed closely the course of Islamic State's evolution. Joanna Cook specialises in terrorism at the Institute for Security and Global Affairs at Leiden University in the Netherlands. Colin Clark is Director of Research at the Sufan Group, a security and intelligence consultancy in New York. I asked him first how significant IS's control of territory had been 10 years ago.
When former ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi ascended to make this announcement, I don't think the world knew, nor could know, how important and how significant this would be. This essentially drove the migration of foreign fighters from around the world, over 80 countries. You had tens of thousands of people that would come to Iraq and Syria to come build this terror proto-state. And I think, you know, when this announcement was made a decade ago, we were in the really early stages of this. We were then consumed by this wave of terrorism that swept the globe in the preceding years and put together a global coalition to defeat it, which took many more years.
Joanna, did it take intelligence communities by surprise when the caliphate was declared?
I think the emergence of the caliphate was really a perfect storm of some factors that could have been clearly identified and some that were really unpredicted. And the legacy of the Arab Spring and the results of that, so for example, the civil war in Syria, was one of these factors that did help facilitate in some ways the emergence of the caliphate. And at that time in Iraq, there was also quite a lot of sectarian grievances present, which also had a compounding factor in this. But some of these things, again, might have been picked up by intelligence services, but I'm not aware of anyone who had a full grasp of what possibly could have emerged in a caliphate that came to be the size of Britain and rule over a population of multiple millions of civilians in Iraq and Syria.
10 years on, Colin, what is going on in the areas where IS used to rule?
Well, you've got a very different picture today than you did 10 years ago. I published a book called After the Caliphate 2019, trying to lay out some of what we're seeing today, and did mention at length the rise of the Islamic State Khorasan in Afghanistan. And that's now the group that I think most of the world is concerned about in terms of the ability to launch external operations. They've been taking a lot of shots against the West. There's been successful attacks in Russia, Iran, and elsewhere, and multiple disrupted plots in Europe. So, you know, you've got a kind of shifting landscape. You have groups in sub-Saharan Africa, Democratic Republic of Congo, Mozambique, all throughout the Sahel that are on the rise. And at the same time, you have other places where ISIS was strong that have really kind of faded. And that's in places like the Sinai Peninsula in Egypt, various countries in Southeast Asia, Libya, Yemen, and elsewhere. So this is almost like a living organism, right? It shifts, it responds, and it reacts to counterterrorism pressure. And that's another area where things have changed as Western countries have really shifted to focus more on what they call great power competition than on global counterterrorism efforts.
If we go back to where it really started in the heart of Iraq and Syria, I mean, today we still have 43,400 individuals remaining in al-Hol camp as family members or those that are seen to have an affiliation with ISIS. 9,000 foreign terrorist fighters still in custody and detention in really horrific circumstances in northeast Syria. And when we look at the population that remains there, it's this lingering legacy of individuals who have been affiliated with the group in various ways, whether direct militants or family members associated with it who have no criminal culpability in relation to the group, but nonetheless are being punished because of the affiliation that our family holds.
And there seems, Joanna, to be a striking lack of international interest in reintegrating them, doesn't there?
Absolutely. It doesn't win political points for anyone to bring back what are perceived to be so-called terrorists. But when we're looking at the population of al-Hol camp, for example, 61% of these are children. 46% of those are Iraqis. And a lot of this has to be the government of Iraq in particular. I really want to highlight this. They are taking such an important step by repatriating those populations from al-Hol camp in a government-led way. And they had to bring back 37,000, or they're in the process of bringing back such a large number. And we see Western nations who are still shirking their responsibilities to bring back handfuls of women and children, leaving them to essentially be condemned to this incredibly unsafe environment that remains in Syria and Iraq.
And Colin, you argue that as an active force, ISIS and its affiliates have got a remarkable ability to adapt and survive. Where are they strongest now? Doing what? And how do they get their money?
Yeah, so let's look across the globe. We could look to South and Central Asia, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and now into certain countries like Tajikistan, where the Islamic State is recruiting quite heavily from, as well as the Tajik diaspora more broadly. Very strong in parts of sub-Saharan Africa, really throughout various pockets of the entire continent. And Somalia in particular, even though there's not a robust presence there because that's largely al-Shabaab territory, which is an al-Qaeda-linked group, you have something called the al-Qarar office, which has played a really instrumental, facilitative and logistical role in kind of moving money and figuring out some of the non-kinetic aspects of how ISIS operates as a global network. So safe houses, fraudulent documents, all of these other logistical points that are critical to how really any non-state actor operates.
And they're funded how?
Well, they're funded through a range of illicit criminal activities, and they're also living off of the legacy of what was at one point the wealthiest terrorist organization the world has ever seen, making millions of dollars a day in some case. That money has been put to work. They've laundered that. They've invested in front companies around the world. And so they're, in some cases, living off of that, supplemented by daily criminal activities where they link up with other elements on the ground to engage in extortion, kidnapping for ransom, and various mafia-style activities where they operate.
And Joanna, going back to the human legacy of ISIS, what about relatives who were in Iraq and Syria, many of whom have returned to Europe and are not in those camps? What's happened to them on their return?
What's very encouraging is that for children who have been returned through state-led processes, they've had intensive rehabilitation programs, so a lot of support from psychologists, social workers, healthcare workers, and these children are returning to regular education and life and thriving. There was a lot of fear around these children being seen as ticking time bombs, but I'm not aware of any plot that has included children returning. These children were victims of their parents' choices. And thank goodness they have been largely successfully returned and reintegrated. But the implications of that period on their life are certain to have long-term implications for them as well. And we can't forget about the victims within Iraq and Syria who also remain. 2,700 Yazidis are also still missing of the 6,000 women and kids that were taken by ISIS. So it's important to not forget about these family members of ISIS, but also the outstanding victims that were directly targeted by ISIS who still remain deeply affected by the caliphate today.
Joanna Cook from Leiden University. Earlier, Colin Clark, author on ISIS. This is the BBC World Service and NewsHour. I'm Paul Henley, and this is NewsHour live from the BBC. The US's conservative-dominated Supreme Court has delivered a big blow to the ability of the government's regulatory agencies to impose rules on big business. Yesterday's overturning of something called the Chevron precedent means, for example, that if an industrial firm pumps dangerous pollutants into local air or water, the Environmental Protection Agency in the US can no longer intervene directly. Instead, it might have to sue the company in a federal court before a jury, and that company could have significant funds to fight its case. 40 years ago, the Supreme Court ruled against the oil giant Chevron, and ever since, multinationals, big pharma and the fossil fuel industry have lobbied for the change that they finally got yesterday. Scott Lucas is professor of US politics at University College Dublin.
The significance of the Supreme Court's decision is that it overturns a precedent set in 1984 in what's been known as the Chevron decision. And in 1984, they said that a U.S. government agency could interpret a law passed by Congress in how those regulations should be applied. And for 40 years, that has been the case. On 70 occasions, the Supreme Court has upheld the power of the agencies to interpret the laws that were set by Congress. What happened yesterday is that the Supreme Court said, no, any interpretation by an agency of the law could be taken to court, and the court could intervene to block that regulation. So this decision expands the power of the judiciary, vastly expands the power of the judiciary, and at the same time limits and even possibly handcuffs government agencies.
Why is there such a row about it? The dissenting judges seem particularly angry.
For years, conservatives on the court had said they wanted to limit judicial intervention, that it was not the place of the court to go in and decide what should or shouldn't be done. And this is a stunning reversal. What the conservatives on the court are saying is, no, we are going to intervene or could intervene potentially at any point. So now in 2024, a company can go back and say, we don't agree with this application of the Clean Air Act, say by the Environmental Protection Agency. And the court can step in and say, no, you're absolutely right. You don't have to abide by it. A pharmaceutical company could say, we don't think we should have to abide by this regulation of drug prices under the Affordable Care Act. And the court could step in and say, no, you're absolutely right. Go ahead and charge whatever you want. So that almost unlimited expansion of judicial power is what the dissenters, the three moderate judges on the court, called out. There's also a worry that was expressed by the judges, but it crosses into the political domain, that there is really a project, a political project now, to try to undermine U.S. agencies, to almost shatter their ability to act. And this is in an environment where Donald Trump and his allies have actually threatened to bury those agencies.
So Donald Trump will be pretty pleased about this change yesterday.
If Trump himself doesn't understand the significance of it, those around him who are backing this would. They had already put out a document hundreds of pages long called Project 2025, assuming they'll get power next year, which says they will go after the agencies, that they'll put their people in place where, for example, you can no longer have an agency applying what we call Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. Now, if the Trump people get control of the agencies, they can simply undermine Obamacare by going to court on each and every occasion when you try to administer that system.
Scott Lucas, who's Professor of US Politics at University College Dublin. Now, the Panama Papers exposed how some of the world's rich and powerful were using tax havens to hide their money. The publications pointed the finger at leaders and celebrities around the globe, but now a court in Panama has acquitted all 28 people who were charged with money laundering. The newsroom's Rachel Wright has this report.
New revelations on how the rich and the powerful hide cash are rocking countries around the world. The so-called Panama Papers contain allegations.
It was a huge story when in 2016, 11.5 million documents were taken from a former Panamanian offshore law firm and corporate service provider, Mossack Fonseca. They found themselves at the center of a massive storm.
Tell him that a group of around 20 or 25 international journalists is in front of your building.
The documents contained personal financial information about wealthy individuals and public officials that had previously been kept private. An anonymous whistleblower leaked the documents to a German newspaper, which asked the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists for help. Will Fitzgibbon from the ICIJ spoke on the day they published the Panama Papers.
I think really the story is about a system that is not meeting the expectations of governments and regulators and is not meeting the standards of the majority of the world's population who have to live by rules that don't allow them to really write to a company and ask how they can form an offshore entity that will enable them to pay less tax.
But the papers did name individual heads of state and government and senior figures from almost every country in the world, among them Iceland's Prime Minister Sigmundur Gunnlaugsson, who was asked by journalists from the national broadcaster about his tax affairs. And then promptly walked out of the interview. With thousands of people protesting on the streets of Reykjavik, he was forced to resign. In total, the data revealed links to 12 current or former heads of state and government, including dictators accused of embezzling money from their own countries. The Argentine football star Lionel Messi, Spanish filmmaker Pedro Almodóvar were also named. In an interview shortly after the expose broke, Mr. Fonseca, the co-founder of the law firm, said they had carefully vetted their clients, but that they were similar to a car factory and that they are not responsible for what is done with the car after it's sold. But under new laws passed by Panama against tax fraud and money laundering, a trial against 29 defendants went ahead in April of this year.
Mi nombre es Jürgen Mossack.
Among the 29 defendants were the law firm's co-founders, one of whom, Raymond Fonseca, died in May while awaiting the verdict. Prosecutors alleged that Mossack Fonseca had created shell companies with the purpose of hiding money earned in illicit activities and that the firm failed to act with due diligence. But the judge said they didn't provide sufficient evidence in the 10-day trial and acquitted all the defendants. The trial may have ended in acquittals, but references to the Panama Papers in television series and music show how the revelations resonated with the public and left a lasting legacy within pop culture. Musicians in multiple countries and languages have written, recorded and performed at least 38 songs titled Panama Papers, including this one by the Shaolin Temple Defenders.
That report from Rachel Wright, ending this edition of NewsHour. Thank you very much for listening. See you next time, we hope.
Neulich auf der EM-Grillparty.
Und Ball gewinnen. Jetzt vielleicht der letzte Angriff gespielt.
Nur noch eine Minute für ein Tor.
Jetzt muss es schnell gehen.
Komm schon, nur noch eine Minute für eine perfekte gegrillte Wurst. Auch nur fürs Essen da? Dann hol dir die vegane Bratwurst von Rügenwalder Mühle. Am besten schmeckt's, wenn's allen schmeckt. Rügenwalder Mühle.